on our docket this afternoon. And I see counsel are armed and ready. We're ready to hear from the appellant. I should tell you that you have 30 minutes because we decided as a court we would do that in death cases. Maybe when that notice went out, you thought, oh, my God. But that's, use the time as you will. But I just wanted to let you know that. Go ahead.
May it please the court. My name is Tom Hurd. I represent Clarence Good. This is Emma Rolls, my co-counsel. Jeff Henderson was a disgrace to law enforcement. He was the opposite of law enforcement officer. He was a law corruption officer. He was a case fixer, upper-level drug dealer.
Well, how much of that is in the record that was submitted to the OCCA?
A lot of it was. There was three types of evidence in that post-conviction action, which, by the way, that post-conviction action was filed, and a few weeks later, this massive federal indictment comes down where a grand jury finds probable cause for a 61-count indictment against...
Yeah, let me be more specific. You have a Brady claim.
Yes.
That means the government didn't disclose something during the trial proceedings, before the end of trial.
Right.
What evidence was submitted to the OCCA of what the government knew by the end of trial? Because I don't see very much there. I think you've got a great case against Henderson. He's terrible. But what do you have to show that the government had information favorable to you at your Brady claim at the trial stage? That was submitted to the OCCA. That's what we're limited
to. There's three types of evidence that was submitted, and we talk about that. The type that everyone seems to be the most interested in are the two internal affairs reports. There was many, many internal affairs reports we know about that...
The two submitted to the OCCA aren't real... I mean, there's nothing like what we know about him now. Do you agree?
Right. They're not as bad. There is lying, like three different kinds of lying, that there's credible evidence that he lied in a probable cause affidavit in that one report. But where we have I think that answers your question is we have this imputation doctrine from Kyle's that Officer Henderson's knowledge is imputed.
Yeah, but you didn't argue that before the OCCA. There's nothing in the OCCA petition that claims that what Henderson knew about himself is imputed to the state.
We certainly talked about it. We had those affidavits from famous peanut Joseph, and
that's what other people knew, but not. I didn't see anything before the OCCA that mentions, that argues that the state is bound by what Henderson knew about himself. And because that wasn't raised before the OCCA never addressed that.
The credit needs to be given that they got the post-conviction application on file. There was all this media attention and all these newspaper articles. There was time constraints that the post-conviction action statutes had. He needed to get it on file, and he got it on file.
Talking about the attorney, post-conviction attorney.
Yes.
Okay.
So he got it on file. He got all that information to the OCA. I'm going to call him the OCA. Is that all right?
Yes. Okay.
Sounds dangerous. But could be offensive.
He got all that information to the OCA. What should have happened It's an evidentiary hearing. We filed a motion for evidentiary hearing on that post-conviction action. These were very serious allegations of planning evidence and threats and
mm-hmm. If you were seeking a motion for, if you were raising a motion for a new trial because of newly discovered evidence, that you'd have a better point on in that respect. Here you're claiming that the government had favorable evidence that it did not turn over. And there wasn't very much. There were two internal affairs reports that were, I'm not even sure how they'd get admitted, how you'd use them at trial, but it wasn't very much.
Well, that's where...
But answer first. What our starting point is the evidence you show that the government knew about misconduct by Henderson. And as far as I can tell, the only thing that was presented to the OCCA in that regard really were the two internal affairs reports. Am I missing something?
There's Supreme Court law about reasonably likely to lead to admissible evidence. There's the fact that starting in 1998, there was all these other internal affairs documents that we still haven't gotten anything on. We still haven't received anything from the state.
You agree, though, that we're bound. We the record we have to deal with is the record presented to OCA. Don't you agree that Cullen versus Penholster says it's, that?
As a starting point, yes. But okay. These allegations, especially that Jeff Henderson had been out to get Clarence Good, had been out to get him for a long time, was determined to pin this crime on him, illegal or legal,
well,
one way or
that's
another.
That's your testimony from Joseph, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And he had refused to testify at trial.
Because he was afraid of Jeff Henderson.
Yeah, but he refused to.
Right. That was enough. That was in front of the OCA. That was enough to trigger... I mean, the fact
that this one individual says that and says Henderson was out to get your client, that should be enough to trigger knowledge by the prosecution that Henderson was a bad actor. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and there's three kinds of evidence.
Because if you're saying that, then any person on the street could say anything bad about any law enforcement officer, and you'd have a Brady violation.
Well,
I don't think it's that easy, is it?
To get to the bottom of it, what happened is they nipped this claim in the bud by saying that, you know, even if he was completely impeached and even without a doubt it would have been the same, everything got frozen. Nobody could go any further. There was no disclosures. The state can't be able to just hide the ball and never.
Who has the burden initially to establish a Brady violation?
Well,
the petitioner does, doesn't he?
Right. And
that's, we're going in a circle here. So what did the government know and why did, and when did they not disclose it? And what was exculpatory?
I want to go back to imputation and how that was through these allegations and these affidavits that it's imputed, and it through those allegations that was in front of the OCA. The post-conviction attorney may not have used the word imputation.
Okay. Well, maybe you're saying this. I don't want to put words in your mouth. What you had that wasn't disclosed is the two internal reports and some statements, some affidavits by Josephs. And you're saying that was enough to entitle you to relief. That's a different question from what I'm asking. I want to start with what data do we have that you're relying on to show you're entitled to some relief? And
The way that the OCA froze everything to where we couldn't get any more information by saying no matter what, no matter how bad he's impeached, without a doubt, we weren't able to get anything. And so when we got to the district court on habeas, we asked for an evidentiary hearing again. And we should have gotten an evidentiary hearing because of the unreasonableness of this freezing by the OCA.
Okay, so say you were tied to an evidentiary hearing. What could you have shown? Then you have to show some prejudice from not having an evidentiary hearing.
Right. And there's,
has anything come out that you're aware of that you present that shows that the government knew about this misconduct by Henderson during Mr. Goode's trial?
We have the internal affairs reports. The doors are open.
Still asking for what? We have the two internal affairs reports. Are there others?
Yes, and starting in 1998, we know that there's 33 altogether. We know that, I think it's...
Of Henderson?
I think it's reasonable to conclude if they're starting in 1998, there was one in 1998, which...
Involving Henderson.
Involving Henderson, nine years before.
Yeah.
And
was that one that was presented to OCA?
That...
Because there were two that were presented. I thought I had them here.
Right. The two internal affairs reports are just the tip of the iceberg. And that's an important point.
And dated, when were they dated?
The two internal affairs reports?
Mm-hmm.
Let me see. They were pre-trial, for
okay.
sure.
All right.
This imputation theory that you're advocating today, are you seeking us to extend the law to catch that imputation, or are you contending that there's existing case law that supports what you're saying? And if so, what is it?
It's Kyle's, and in your court, it's McCormick, where it wasn't a police officer,
it was a chemist?
No, it wasn't.
Gilchrist?
No, it wasn't Gilchrist.
A name that will live in infamy?
It was I think it had to do with a rape.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
But, okay.
So,
let's take that up. Let's assume, I think contrary to the record, that you preserved the imputation argument before OCA. Even if you had preserved it, let's say they reject it, or even if they don't reject it, we have to decide what was clearly established law at the time of the trial, don't we? And was the imputation theory clearly established by Supreme Court precedent at the time?
Let's see. When was the Kyle's case?
Because some circuits don't accept it now. I thought the Second Circuit doesn't reject the imputation when it relates to misconduct in an unrelated investigation.
They look at the facts and circumstances of each case, and they wind up ruling on materiality, and it winds up being an advisory opinion, essentially. But the point is that it's this limitation of the imputation doctrine is the new law that the respondent is asking for. We have the clearly established law regarding the imputation doctrine.
And that is Kyle's.
Kyle's. And many, many other cases.
Bagley. Bagley, I assume you're relying
yes,
on Bagley.
Yes. So the OCA says, even if he's completely impeached, and everybody wants to focus on just if we take out his testimony, there's a lot more to it than that, and that's also Supreme Court law.
Isn't that what would have happened, though? If the state would have been aware, let's assume that the state was aware, of the internal affairs reports, the two that are cited, and it had come across the prosecutor's desk, said, oh, if we put Detective Henderson on, he may get impeached with this information, that's bad. Presumably, the prosecutor would say, how valuable is this evidence? And the answer was, it wasn't worth the time. And so they just wouldn't have called Detective Henderson.
I think that there's a couple of different answers to that. One is, if you take everything as true, which you have to do under, for example, the evidentiary hearing standard, that the defense would call him, because here's this case fixer out planting evidence, tainting the case. He's a upper level drug dealer. He's the big dog Tulsa cop dealing with the little Owasso cops. And there's taint all over every, and the Kyle's case talks about this too, the good faith of the investigation, the thoroughness of the investigation, it all gets tainted, every state witness.
When did you first make that argument? I don't think you preserved that either, did you? Did you make that before?
State post-conviction, they were just trying to file.
They didn't make the broad taint argument you're talking about now.
Right.
They were just talking about impeaching Henderson.
And
isn't that correct?
Well, I don't know why they would have submitted these affidavits from Peanut and his wife. It had more to do. It did more than just hurt his testimony. It did more than just impeach his testimony. It hurt their entire case.
But is that argued? I don't think Oka's opinion recognized that argument, and I don't think there was an argument in the petitions before Oka.
I mean, it's more reason why an evidentiary hearing should have been held. And the post-conviction action did say enough. It did say Brady and progeny. It did present all this evidence.
Well, one element of Brady is prejudice. And the prejudice argued was they could have impeached. He could have impeached Henderson.
Well, and they also said this case is continuing to unfold. It's going to evolve. There's going to be all these terrible other things to come out, but they had to get it on file. And then the other just froze everything with this, even if completely impeached, no matter what, without a doubt, which is very unreasonable, without a doubt, with all this crazy Jeff Henderson, all the things he was doing, there can't be without a doubt on everything that was in that post-conviction, all the attachments. And there was enough allegations to get the ball rolling on this case. A death penalty case.
Okay. Let me ask you about the general argument you're making here is this stuff comes out. Mr. Good's attorney seeks post-conviction relief when he sees these newspaper articles and he has a couple internal affairs things. And he doesn't make a lot of the arguments that you're making now. And you're saying that's because the OC's, the OCA, cut him off and he was just trying to get things there and so on. Is there any authority that we can ignore the fact that an argument wasn't raised in state court in those circumstances?
I'd make a couple of points in response to that. One is, they have these very severe rules. You have to have 60 days. You have to get your claim on file in post-conviction acts. And
well, once it's on file and you've met your deadline, can't you seek leave to supplement or amend?
What happened in this case is another thing that's really, I mean, in a death penalty case with these extremely serious allegations, the state doesn't respond unless the Court of Criminal Appeals tells them to. No response. There's nothing to even get going on disputes. And before anything else can happen, the indictment comes down, boom, this opinion comes down and just freezes everything in place. In a death penalty case with really severe allegations and
so
nothing.
How long between the time of your petition, your post-conviction petition, and the OCA opinion rejecting it? Was it a matter of a couple of weeks, is what you're saying?
What I can tell you, I think, is around 8 weeks between that indictment and their opinion. The OCA knew about that indictment, and all these pre-trial horrendous things that Jeff Henderson was doing, fabricating evidence, perjuring, suborning perjury, all that was in that indictment, but everything got frozen. And it wasn't very long.
Could you have supplemented your petition with the indictment? Was there anything keeping you from doing that? So that would be on the record?
If the post-conviction attorney would have thought of that, he could have, I suppose. But The OCA knew about it. They cited it. They acknowledged it. They knew well that this was extremely serious, that the Tulsa police corruption was overwhelming, and instead everything just got nipped in the bud. Okay, this is a flower in the bud.
Why wasn't it fair for the or proper for the OCCA to look at the testimony that Henderson provided, the evidence that he found in the vast gathering of all evidence in this case and testimony that was obtained, and to see whether or not that evidence was weighty or significant or pivotal? Isn't that a reasonable approach here?
Well, with Mr. Good, through post-conviction, saying that we're just getting started on this, facts are unfolding.
Well, you could say Henderson's an axe murderer. The point is, let's look at the trial of Goody's case and the evidence submitted there and the testimony heard, and then determine, given the fact that Henderson's an axe murderer, does it matter?
That, I mean, they said without a doubt, and I call that extremely unreasonable, and I could explain why.
Well, do you not agree that his role in this case was very minor?
I would call it a linchpin, actually.
The finding of the casings is a linchpin?
Yes, because what it did, both as to guilt phase and especially as to sentencing stage as well. You know, they said there's zero doubt, essentially, without a doubt, zero doubt, with all those unreliable witnesses they had to rely on. It's iffy evidence.
But the finding of the casings and what happened after the murders, who was where and where they were going in the car and all of that, wasn't there corroboration through the finding of the gloves?
I think the glove evidence was...
And who needs the casings?
The glove evidence was extremely iffy. I talked about that in our briefing. And the more I look at the glove evidence, the weirder and more bizarre it gets. And then you...
It was found and the location of where it was found.
You had a search party.
Wasn't that significant?
A search party was going 4 miles that they didn't set the predicate for. And all of a sudden, a quarter mile away from the search party, some other guys find some gloves. And they don't even match. Bunny doesn't match it up. Bunny's testimony is horrible on the gloves. It doesn't, and the defense counsel says this glove evidence doesn't do anything. You can see the desperation in the prosecution. They have all this kind of iffy, the jailhouse informant, trying to say there's a relationship between Clarence Good and Penny Avens. You see them really stretching at different points, and it's like trying to call a basketball game that's a squeak or a blowout, saying without a doubt.
What do we do about his confession to his girlfriend?
It's so unbelievable. It's very unbelievable.
It's up to the jury, isn't it?
Right, it is. But she said, she's talking about a shotgun, and she's under duress. Her trigger point is she's going to lose her kids. She starts making death threats or she starts making deals. And all of a sudden, this new evidence, this, mm-hmm. she's just spieling about
counsel,
a shotgun.
Did defense counsel have the opportunity to cross-examine her?
Yes.
And
yes.
Did?
Yes.
Severely?
Yes.
Yes.
As far as a reasonable probability of a different outcome, I'm not sure that I understand what the defense theory is. Is the defense theory that Michelle Chastain was one of the three shooters?
She was, at the very least, I think, very reasonable to that the jury would determine that she was at least an aider and abettor, at the very least,
but
which makes her a corroborator. And then you have their two star witnesses or corroborators.
Well, we know that there were three firearms, and so that reasonable inference would be there were three people there with a firearm. And we know there were three people in Walmart parking lot, right. And we know that 3 hours after that, there's a telephone call to Peanut at 1:03 a.m., and there was no activity on the phone for an hour and a half or an hour and 15 minutes before that, Mr. Good, or how do you say his name?
Good.
Okay.
Yeah, it's tough. It's
the Dutch pronunciation.
And then we know that supposedly Mr. Good makes it to Michelle Chastain's home at 4-something in the morning. And then I believe Peanut says at 6 o'clock in the morning, here they are together again, Mr. Thompson, Ronald Thompson, and the defendant at his house. And so we have this 8-hour period where guess who's together a lot and three shooters. That seems like it's pretty strong evidence, just the clock.
We don't know three shooters. And even Bunny and Michelle, their testimony does not, Bunny doesn't see Clarence Good shooting anybody. He doesn't testify to that. Bunny can't remember half the things that happened.
That's what he started off with. He started off with when he's confronted in the jail by the friend of the victims, he says, oh, I was so high, I can't, which only makes sense because he doesn't want to get in a confrontation or whatever else. But I don't take that as established fact for the rest of the case, that in fact he was so high he can't remember. He testified what happened.
But he does not, his testimony at trial was, he said that he did not see Clarence Good do any shooting. Michelle talks about a shotgun with Mitch. That's all that she has. And it's a shotgun. And I'd really like to get into the sentencing stage, but I also see that there's only 4 minutes left, so I'd like to reserve my time.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the court. Jennifer Crabb on behalf of the respondent. I'd like to start with the point that Judge Hartz was asking about, and that is that this was a two-page post-conviction application as far as this particular proposition goes. There were two paragraphs of law and then one paragraph of argument. And as far as the tainting the whole case goes, the conclusion says that the evidence was, quote, material to an assessment of Officer Henderson's credibility. So that was the theory that was before the Court of Criminal Appeals and was not, and therefore is not properly before this court. As far as Kyles versus Whitley goes and what that clearly establishes, in that case, there was an eyewitness to the abduction of the victim. Her trial testimony was extremely compelling. She told a very strong story about what she saw. However, when she actually witnessed the abduction, she didn't tell anyone. She wasn't even completely certain that it was an abduction. And then in her initial police statements, she told different varying things about whether she thought she could identify the victim or couldn't, could identify the perpetrator or couldn't, and some other things. And those were, it was police reports. It was records of the police investigation that were not disclosed. And so that was imputed to the state because it was part of the prosecution of that case. And that's why Kyles does not clearly establish, and we pointed out both in our brief and then in my 28J letter, that the weight of authority is against imputing unrelated criminal activity by police officers against the state.
Now, let me ask you, in Kyle, the Brady evidence was something you could clearly use to cross-examine the witness. What's the practice in Oklahoma with respect to impeaching officers based on internal investigation reports in other cases? Do you get to cross-examine the officer and say, didn't you misbehave here? Or does the judge allow that? Is it considered collateral impeachment? Can you give us some guidance on that?
Sure. And I am not familiar with any case law on this. This would be just my basic understanding of the rules of evidence in our state, would be that you could ask the officer if it were probative of his truthfulness, but if he denied it, you would not be able to admit collateral evidence of that. And certainly...
So you wouldn't actually refer to the disciplinary report at the trial. You would just ask, didn't you lie in preparing an affidavit for a search warrant or something like that?
I suppose you could probably even ask, isn't it true that your office's internal affairs division concluded that you lied?
Really?
I believe so, although, you're not, as I said, I'm not familiar with any cases that flesh out the scope of that. Certainly in this case, it's the one IA report that we have is just an investigation, and we don't know what conclusions they reached. We don't know whether Officer Henderson was disciplined at all. The other doesn't have anything to do with truthfulness. He did fail to tell the dispatcher that he was going to this bar to settle this personal dispute. Okay. But he didn't lie to her about his location. He just failed to tell her where he was going. And so I don't believe that any of the information in either of these reports would have been admissible at trial.
If the prosecutors knew about those two reports, as well as countless others, and I realized that a number of them came after this trial, but however many of them there were, do you say that there's no duty to turn that over?
I don't, Your Honor, and I think we said in our brief that at least with respect to the one for which he was disciplined, it should have been turned over, although I think its usefulness is pretty minimal. But yes, certainly if the prosecutor has IA reports in their possession that are material, and the prosecutor, I think, is the one who gets to make that determination. And I don't think this one was material, but as best practice in an abundance of caution, certainly it should have been turned over. Yes.
And it wasn't in existence at the time of trial. Is that what you're saying?
The two that we have
right.
were. Yes, that's
were,
correct.
They were in existence.
They
so
were
there was
in existence.
A duty, you're saying, to turn over the report that said there's potential for discipline here.
That he was disciplined, yes. The one for which he was disciplined, correct. The bar.
That one had nothing to do with his veracity.
It didn't, right.
That was misusing his power as a police officer to settle a personal score or something like that.
Correct. And that's why I say really in an abundance of caution that one probably should have turned over, although I think
so you're admitting a Brady violation here?
No, because a Brady violation requires three prongs. But I am conceding that the state probably should have turned over the one IA report.
But the other one doesn't have findings, but it does have accusations of not telling the truth. Is that right?
Correct.
And that's not something that you turn over ordinarily?
Well, it's merely accusations. And so we don't know what there were conflicting stories within. This is just kind of a gathering of witness statements, and the witnesses told conflicting stories. So we don't know which one was telling the truth and which one wasn't.
So if a citizen makes an accusation against an officer, maybe 10 citizens make accusations against officers in 10 different incidents, but there's no finding by the police department that the officer misbehaved, then that's not potential Brady evidence?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The problem that you get into is it's not admissible, and then the trial becomes about the veracity of the police officer under Oklahoma's evidence code, Section 2403. The trial court can exclude evidence if it has the potential for distracting the jury, confusing the issues.
But here, as you just said earlier, all the defense attorney could do is cross-examine the officer and say, didn't you beat up so-and-so? Didn't you beat up so-and-so? Didn't you beat up so-and-so? I mean, the court could keep that out, but it's not real time-consuming.
No, you're right, it's not. But it is prejudicial to ask a witness without foundation, isn't it true you lied?
And it's not sufficient foundation to have a citizen file a complaint against somebody?
I'm not sure if it is or not, Your Honor, but at the end of the day, I think it's prejudicial to have a witness asked, basically, isn't it true you're a liar? And then he says no. And I don't know really what the point of that is within the trial.
Well, you say that it will turn into a trial of the officer, but there's another alternative, which is the prosecution looks at this witness and says, you're not worth it because you either may have minor evidence or you're just so bad that it will turn into a trial of the officer. The jury will get mad and walk away. Here, if that evidence, if all of the evidence that might have been available to impeach Officer Henderson and really do more than that, mm-hmm. anger the jury, mm-hmm. if that had come out, or if the prosecutor would have had to deal with that and say, Henderson, you're not worth it. All you did was find the 22 casings in the live round, so goodbye. We're not going to need you today. That would have been important on penalty. Tell me why it wouldn't. Because the reason that I'm concerned there is when Mr. Thompson says that he threw the casings in the round and they're later found, that really does support the notion that he was the one who had the 22. And that matters because the .357 is what was shot into the heads of these three people, as I understand it. And that really helps with Michelle Chastain's account of Scarface and look at me before you die and all of that stuff. And that's the sort of thing that I can see a jury saying death penalty on. That is really something. And so Henderson mattered. Tell me why Henderson didn't matter as far as connecting himself to that 22.
Sure. I agree with Your Honor that it does make it at least somewhat more probable that Ronald Thompson had the 22, although somewhat more probable.
Isn't that the whole point of it?
No, I don't believe so. I think it's just more evidence that corroborates his story as a whole, just as the gloves did in the Walmart surveillance video. I think it's more evidence that corroborates his story, and it particularly ties petitioner into the murder when you consider the phone call to Mr. Joseph's home as they drove over there to discard the casings. But it does not. It bolsters Mr. Thomas's credibility, but it doesn't specifically bolster his credibility regarding the fact that petitioner was the one who had the .357. Although in that regard, I would point out that what's stronger is that petitioner told Michelle Chastain that he is the one who shot Mitch Thompson, and Mitch Thompson was only shot with the .357. So it's really petitioner's own words that put the .357 in his hand, even more so than Ronald Thompson's. And as far as the materiality of that, of the casings to the second stage, I would point out that the state didn't even mention Officer Henderson during second stage. And the Supreme Court found that significant in Strickler versus Green and pointed out that after they found that the evidence was not material for first stage, they pointed out that the prosecutor did not rely on the evidence in second stage and found that to be relevant to their materiality analysis. So it was petitioner's own words that put that .357 in his hand.
Sorry, what did you say? I just missed what you said about not being material to the second stage. What were you referring to? That wasn't argued before OCA, is what you're saying?
It was, I believe it was alluded to. It certainly wasn't, as I said before, this was a two-page proposition, and
does it argue prejudice in the second stage?
It states the very last sentence says that this court should find that the state violated its obligations imposed by Brady and its progeny, and Mr. Good's sentences should be reversed and his case remanded back to the district court for a new trial.
I thought you were talking about what the state argued in the penalty phase, and that the state did not mention Henderson's testimony.
Correct.
That's what you were saying.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
As far as materiality goes in the first stage, this case really does closely parallel Strickler versus Green. In that case, the lower courts had granted relief, and the district court had found that there was a reasonable possibility of a different result, and the Supreme Court said that, yes, this evidence made petitioner's conviction more likely, and that impeachment might have changed the outcome, and we agree there's a reasonable possibility, but that's not the standard. The standard here is whether there's a reasonable probability of a different result. And because the record provided strong support that the petitioner would have been convicted even if this witness had been severely impeached. The court found the evidence was not material. And this was on de novo review. In this case, you owe deference to the Court of Criminal Appeals. And one thing I'd like to point out is the idea that there's a difference between corroboration in the legal sense and corroboration in the broader sense. As a matter of state law, Ronald Thompson's testimony had to be corroborated in order for the jury to consider it, but that requires only one piece of evidence, however slight, which tends to connect the defendant to the offense. And here we have petitioner's confession to Michelle Chastain. We have his statements to Fred Clemens, which even if those statements are not regarded as a confession, certainly petitioner disclosed many details of the offense to Mr. Clemens, which is corroboration. And then once Mr. Thompson's testimony is corroborated, you can consider it as a whole. And then you go to what I think of as kind of the broader idea of corroboration, which is everything that supports his testimony. And when you look at that, you have, as Judge Phillips was pointing out, that petitioner was with Ronald Thompson and Kenneth Johnson both before and after these murders were committed. You have the gloves, which there were a total of 25 gloves found during the search, but these four were together. It was one latex glove, one blue glove, and then the other was a blue glove. It was obvious that someone had put on the latex glove and then the blue glove and then pulled them off together, and they're inside out and they're together. And I think petitioner's brief says that they were not blue on the outside, but in fact they are. States Exhibit 77 is a close-up picture of one of the gloves, and it's blue and off-white on the outside, which is entirely consistent with Ronald Thompson's testimony that Mr. Johnson and petitioner put on a latex glove with a blue glove over it.
Didn't he say a batting glove?
He said a batting glove, and then at one point he said a painter's glove. So he wasn't clear on exactly what kind of glove it is, but it was blue, and it was as opposed to a latex type glove, and this is what we found to get all together.
There were four together, as though they'd been thrown out of a moving car.
I don't believe that anybody stated that at trial, but they were right off of the road, and these four were in an area right by each other, yes. You have, as I referenced, petitioner's confession to Miss Chastain, which the waitress at Denny's took note of this conversation that was going on. She did not hear what was said, but she observed that Miss Chastain was crying and that petitioner looked stern during the conversation. You also have Miss Chastain saying that petitioner called a number of times and threatened her, including when she was at the hospital with her father. And there was an officer who was with Miss Chastain when one of those calls came in, and he could hear a male voice on the other end of the phone.
What about Penny Avon saying that Miss Chastain had said, please tell the police that he confessed to you two, and then they'll be more apt to believe it? Doesn't that undercut everything you just said?
Well, that was up to the jury to decide, Your Honor. And the jury were the ones who could see both of those witnesses and make a credibility determination. But I would point out that in closing argument, it's in Volume 8, on page 1691, defense counsel made a comment that I think is very telling about Miss Avon's. He said that she was, quote, a little bit excitable. She's sort of like champagne. Once it comes out, it pops. That's Penny. And then the prosecutor responded on page 1701 and said that he believed that her testimony was enjoyable to her. Michelle Chastain said that she believed that Miss Avon's was interested in petitioner. I would point out that Miss Avon's has provided two affidavits in this case in support of petitioner. And in one of them, she speaks of him providing money to help her take care of herself because she's separated from her husband. So I think it was up to the jury to decide whom to believe, and they evidently believed Miss Chastain and not Miss Avon's.
We don't know that, though, do we? They could have convicted and thought she was the biggest liar that ever came down the pike.
They could have, but when you look at all the other evidence, which I haven't even gotten to all of it. For one thing, as I said, there's some evidence that tends to corroborate her, which is that waitress at the Denny's restaurant, as well as the officer who heard that she was on the phone with a man. And then you have the phone records, which tie petitioner to this crime. Mr. Thompson says they went over to Peanut's house. Based on neighbors, we know that these murders happened around 12:45. This is when the neighbor's dogs started barking. At 1:03, petitioner calls Mr. Joseph, and then they show up over there and they get rid of the shell casings. You also have the petitioner was not truthful with police. He told a couple of different stories about what he did after picking Mr. Thompson up from the Walmart. He also, although one of the affidavits from Mr. Joseph indicates that they've been friends for 30 years, that he considers petitioner like his brother, when petitioner's asked about Peanut, he says, "I know a lot of Peanuts," unwilling to connect himself to somebody who's connected with this case. You also have that a portion of a latex glove was found in Mr. Johnson's car, which further corroborates Mr. Thompson, and we know that they used that car at least to pick Mr. Thompson up from the Walmart. And then you have motive. The petitioner had motive in this case. There was a dispute over the Xanax pills, over the fact that J.R. Thompson, who was another intended target in this case, wrecked Michelle Chastain's car and was not helping get it repaired. And then the fact that Mitch Thompson tried to get petitioner fired, did get Michelle Chastain fired from her job, tried to take her children away. So as both the Court of Criminal Appeals and the District Court found, this was a compelling case for guilt. Certainly compelling enough that the Court of Criminal Appeals decision was not so unreasonable that no fair-minded jurist could agree with it. If the court doesn't have any questions.
I have questions about mitigation. Could you address that?
Sure, absolutely. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were going to ask me a question. Yes, I'll be happy to address it. With respect to the mental health aspects of mitigation, that was not raised until the third post-conviction application and therefore was procedurally barred. Petitioner claims that the bar is not independent, but that claim was not made to the district court, at least not the same independence argument was made to the district court.
So you're talking about the OCCA's ruling on the third petition?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And
yes.
In that ruling, the court first said it's barred, right?
Correct.
But then it went on to actually address the merits. Isn't that a problem?
It went on to address the merits of the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel claim, which is not even a constitutional claim. Unlike in the Sullivan case, where appellate counsel was, and in fact, in Sullivan, which I would point out was an unpublished order denying COA that dealt with Wyoming's statute, there was an antecedent determination that had to be made before the procedural bar could be imposed as to whether appellate counsel was ineffective. That's not the way it works in Oklahoma. As Judge Briscoe pointed out, they did first find it to be barred as a matter of state law, and then they looked to see whether the bar could be, quote, overcome by the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, which is the same language that the Supreme Court used in Strickler versus Green, talking about cause and prejudice as to whether the cause could overcome the procedural bar. So here, the bar was imposed purely as a matter of state law, and then it was actually a further question of state law in this case as to whether post-conviction counsel could excuse the failure to raise the claim earlier.
And you're looking at ineffective assistance of counsel at post-conviction, and that's why you're saying it's not a Sixth Amendment violation?
Correct.
Well, was that their claim? Was it only focused on post-conviction counsel? Was it not also focused on trial counsel and appellate counsel?
The claim was an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim, but the attempt to avoid the bar was solely one of post-conviction counsel for not raising the trial counsel claim, yes, which they even acknowledged in that post-conviction application. They said it was a constitutional right, the post-conviction counsel, but of course it's not. And then they also said it was a statutory right to effective post-conviction counsel.
Did they say it was a federal constitutional right?
They did not specify. It just said constitutional and statutory right, yes.
What should we make of the fact that the trial attorney, Mr. Monroe, and the trial investigator, Mr. Cullen, both basically confess error and say, we didn't do enough, we thought we had to win this on the guilt phase, and then we have a very meager mitigation case, the mother and the fiancé, which did not last very long at all, 20 pages in the transcript or something like that. That doesn't sound like a very thorough investigation.
Well, in fact, Your Honor, first I'll start by talking about their affidavits. In Harrington versus Richter, at 109 to 110, the Supreme Court said that after an adverse verdict at trial, even the most experienced counsel may find it difficult to resist asking whether a different strategy might have been better, and in the course of that reflection, to magnify their own responsibility for an unfavorable outcome. So I would just point that out to begin with. I would also point out that Mr. Monroe, his recollection of this time is apparently not entirely accurate, because he states in paragraph 17 that Dr. Draper's report was inaccurate because it was silent as to the gang and drug activities of petitioner. And that is not too true. It's true with respect to the drugs, but not with respect to the gang activity. It looks like trial counsel believes that he had asked Dr. Draper to omit gang activity from her report, but that is not accurate. And then when you look at both of their affidavits, they both indicate that what they should have done was pressed the witnesses more. And I'm speaking specifically paragraph 10 of Mr. Cullen, and I believe it's paragraph 12 of Mr. Monroe, which to me is a tacit admission that they did ask these. And we know that Dr. Draper talked to mother, brother, girlfriend, teacher, pastor. I can't recall right now all
the
of
the criticism was they didn't elicit things like the child sexual abuse and all. And they're saying they didn't do enough to defend, just saying the investigators for the defense didn't do enough to gain the confidence of these people and elicit that information.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct. And I'm aware of no Supreme Court authority which requires counsel to ask a certain number of times or a certain way. Counsel talked to all of these witnesses, and in most importantly to petitioner himself, who should have been aware of all of this information. Petitioner admitted at trial that he had spent some time, or had talked, I think he said, at some length with both counsel and with Dr. Draper about his mitigation case, and that he understood its purpose.
I'm sorry, where did he say that?
He said that.
At trial?
At trial, yes, Your Honor.
When he testified during the penalty phase?
He did not testify, but he told the trial court.
Okay.
When they had a discussion, because Dr. Draper was hired but did not testify, what happened is that when the jury was ready to return its first stage verdict, they sent out a note asking whether they would have an escort to their cars. And then so trial counsel made a record that he had decided not to call Dr. Draper because he was worried about the gang information in her report.
And probably the criminal and the criminal convictions as well.
Correct.
In there as well.
Correct. The jury did know about his conviction for possession of a firearm after former conviction of a felony, but they did not know about anything else. And so at page 1797 of the transcript, that's where petitioner said that he had discussed mitigation at some length with both counsel and with Dr. Draper. So what we have here, in spite of the fact that I agree, Judge Phillips, there was not a lot of mitigation presented. They presented everything of which they were aware and which they thought would be helpful. And they did so after a thorough investigation. We know that they got school records, medical records, mental health records, all the records that one usually gets. And they talked to family members and friends, all of the people that counsel typically speak to. And the story that they were given was that he had good parents. In fact, even on direct appeal, the affidavit still said he was raised by such a good family. We know he was taught right. It was when he became a teenager, he succumbed to peer pressure and became involved in gangs.
But in the record, two things struck me. Number one, during the closing of the second phase, the government attorney is saying, notice, ladies and gentlemen, you didn't hear any evidence of X or Y or Z, which there would have been evidence of. And then the defendant's counsel gets up and says, it is what it is. We could have brought it. Bringing in 20 experts probably wouldn't have made any difference or something. That sounds deficient.
Well, you say which there would have been evidence of. That depends on which version of petitioner's life, the one that was presented at trial or on direct appeal or in the first post-conviction or the third post-conviction, you believe. It's not until the third post-conviction application that we have any insinuation that there was any sort of bad childhood. The sexual abuse did come up for the first time in the first post-conviction. It was simply hearsay by the girlfriend who says the petitioner told her that.
The mother said.
The mother says that in a third post-conviction, which is barred by Penholster because that claim was barred by the time we get to the third post-conviction application.
Well, we're talking first petition, aren't we?
Well, that's
mental health was the third.
Mental health was the third. Substance abuse and sexual abuse was both the first and the third.
Yes. And so being in the first, they're a fair game, aren't they?
Well, the only evidence of it presented to the Court of Criminal Appeals in the first post-conviction was the statement by LaKendra Carter, the girlfriend. The mother's affidavit did not come along until the third post-conviction application. So the record before the Court of Criminal Appeals had only the girlfriend's statement that petitioner told her. And we know that petitioner didn't tell Dr. Draper because she says in her report there was no abuse. So this is like Smith versus Workman, where counsel asked but never got the information that because the witnesses were not forthcoming. If the court does not have any further questions, I would ask you to affirm the district court's judgment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. If you look at the sentencing stage closing argument, it is all about forensics and who shot what gun. Henderson's evidence is crucial on that. The prosecutors were desperate not to make it look like that they made the deal with the worst guy. They didn't want the jury to think, why should we give a death sentence when the state's witness got a life without parole. Over and over again in their closing arguments, who shot what guns, this tangible physical nexus with the Officer Henderson's evidence was vital. Another point on the sentencing stage on the Brady error, I find striking this closing argument that defense counsel made. He said, sometimes long after trial is over, something is revealed. Before you choose this irreversible punishment of death, you should really think about whether anything was misinterpreted or fabricated or stretched or misstated. Henderson was crucial on that. That was a prescient argument. Jeff Henderson finally did happen. He finally was exposed. And with an evidentiary hearing, we would get to the bottom of all of that. Now, on the IAC claim, Judge Phillips was exactly right on the two points. We have the defense counsel saying, it is what it is. We have the prosecution. It's like a list of all the things, the opposite of what Clarence Good was. He did have an alcoholic father. He did have this issue. He did, I have that quote, but you've seen it in the record. Every single thing in that paragraph was the exact opposite. And in a way, it's the same thing with Jeff Henderson. He comes to the courtroom. He's the imprimatur of the government, the law enforcement officer that you trust and respect. He was the opposite of that. He was a kingpin drug dealer.
But that doesn't mean that Mr. Good isn't guilty. He can, as Judge Prisco said, he can be an axe murderer. But still, I guess I'm still hung up on why does that 22 matter except potentially for the penalty.
I'm sorry? Oh, the 22?
The casings and the live round.
It's all about Bunny being, you know, the state didn't believe half of what Bunny said. You know, Bunny said they went straight to the house from Walmart. State said, no, he's lying.
And rang the doorbell.
Right, rang the doorbell. Doesn't make any sense. And this story where he was surprised. He went down to the left for some unknown reason. He had no idea and he was forced into all this. He's the guy with the most motive. So, I have a few quick things. I've just got less than a minute left. I want to make a point again about these internal affairs we don't know about. They had a duty. There's numerous internal affairs documents we don't know about. We haven't gotten to the bottom of any of this at all. We need a hearing.
We can't do that. But let me ask, how would you use these internal affairs documents? You talk about then you'd investigate and discover that Henderson was a bad person, but could you use those documents at trial, or if so, how?
You know, we haven't even got into the... It was nipped in the bud. We have Napu and Giglio. These prosecutors, come on, they had to have known about this guy. He did so many things, so many odd occurrences, bribing, stealing. We don't know about the attorney aspect of it.
And you've made that point many times. And it's a good point perhaps to make in state court. But we can't do anything about that. One is we're stuck with the record presented to the state court under Cullen versus Penholster. I haven't heard any exception to that doctrine here. And second, although there might be other stuff there, we can't reverse on the possibility that there's stuff out there that might be prejudicial. You have to show the prejudice from having things nipped in the bud. And we don't see that.
So prosecutors and police officers can just keep hiding the ball. Is that, I mean, there's something that doesn't compute.
Well, you can go to OCA and say, now we have more evidence that Brady evidence wasn't presented. It sounds to me, though, that it's less a Brady argument than a newly discovered evidence that you wish you could have used at trial to impeach the person. It sounds more like that than that the government failed to produce this evidence when the government didn't have it.
I keep talking about nipped in the bud, but that segues into the futility of it all. They said no matter what. They said even if he was completely impeached, without a doubt, we were stuck.
Well,
we were frozen.
Again, they were looking at the record they had in front of them. I mean, I think their analysis is reasonable. I mean, they can't go off on supposition, on evidence that's not presented.
If there's some threshold matters with all the swirling around and the seriousness of the allegations, they should have granted the motion for an evidentiary hearing.
And you don't have to show a Brady violation before you get an evidentiary hearing?
It comes first. You don't have to prove your case before the hearing.
Yeah.
You just have to reach a threshold level.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I've gone over my time. I don't know if you want to keep asking questions.
I don't have any.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case is submitted. We appreciate your arguments. Court is in recess until 9:00.